All the Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome once again to All the Rage. We're going to be talking this week again about some worker actions and activities going on around all over the place, all over different parts of the world during these times, with the terrible coronavirus still taking its toll. Obviously, once again, as we always say, solidarity to everybody out there. Do not, you know, suffer in silence and do not suffer alone. There are many, many support groups which we are happy to support in these times. And also the same pledge goes out to all of the Black Lives Matter disputes that are going on around the world. Full and complete solidarity from the end of this laptop, certainly. We're lucky enough this week again to be joined by a frequent guest and good pal of the show, Mr. Jeremy Woodcock.
Brilliant to be on again, as always.
Thanks, mate. It's always good to have you on. Some of the issues we're going to be talking about tonight, no, actually, I'm fairly confident in saying all of them, are not things that tend to get a tremendous amount of play in the mainstream media at the best of times, and at the moment they tend to have been forgotten about. But I think they're worth highlighting, doing the non-mainstream is what we like to do here at All the Rage. So we're going to start with Amazon, the lovely company that most of you can't live without. They've shown themselves to be the beating blackened heart of late period capitalism yet again, where profit is completely valued over human life. There have been numerous reports of outbreaks of COVID-19 in their warehouses, fulfillment centres they call them. But to people like me and Dave of our age group, this is a fucking warehouse, mate. Okay. Yeah, we'll talk about that phrase some other day. But in many cases, there have been subsequent worker action to this COVID-19 outbreak, so having just sat back and done nothing about it. We'll start with America. One warehouse near, I'm told its geographical location, is the foothills of the Pocono Mountains, which is northeastern Pennsylvania, has become Amazon's biggest COVID-19 hotspot. More employees here have been infected by the coronavirus than in any of Amazon's roughly 500 other facilities in the United States, according to a report by Karen Weiss of the New York Times. In the same article, she writes, quote, "At first, Amazon told workers about each new case, but when the total reached about 60, the announcement stopped giving specific numbers," end quote. Amazon workplaces were seeing the pandemic in February when they were concerned about their global supply chain and consulted an infectious diseases specialist. I'm not quite sure what advice they got from there, but nevertheless. Since then, they have since stopped releasing numbers. In Seattle, they saw outbreaks happening from early March and told staff that they could work from home. Seattle, of course, being the kind of office place where they have for Amazon. Again, we have a company that simply cannot and must not get away with claiming that they do not have enough money to treat their staff well, or they don't have enough money to furlough their staff. Amazon has, in fact, been making ridiculous amounts of profit during the pandemic alone and beforehand. Shut down and the growing, basically the growing babies who order even more playthings during that shutdown. It simply must be delivered as soon as possible, if not sooner. According to the NY Times piece, Jeff Bezos told investors, quote, that pay increases, safety measures, and testing efforts would cost more than $4 billion this quarter, end of quote. And they asked existing staff to work more overtime whilst hiring in the US at least around 175,000 more. US estimates alone say grocery orders are up by 50%, and this is from an article that's actually about 2 months old now. So even more people in the factories where social distancing is also a near impossibility. These factories are being kept open even as infections increase. Their white-collar workforce was sent home in the first week of April. There has been, as we discussed, worker resistance to this. In the US, various walkouts have taken place, such as the warehouse workers in Staten Island demanding protection, safety conditions, plus proper sick pay. This is also in conjunction with workers at a company called Instacart calling for the same thing. The Amazon workers want their warehouse closed and deep cleaned, and the Instacart workers have called for disinfectant wipes. Amazon workers have also reported hand sanitizer running out in factories. One high-profile member of staff has walked walked out of Amazon's treatment of protesting members of staff, specifically whistleblowers, to the company's terrible conditions. One such whistleblower at the aforementioned Staten Island branch was Christian Smith, an assistant manager who led co-workers in walkouts after 30 people tested positive, and they decided to demand cleaning, protection, etc., that kind of stuff. Leaked memos from the company show how they plan to discredit Smalls. This is apparently now being investigated by authorities. Actually, there's been quite a bit of info since I first started writing about this show that Amazon have directly and actively tried to smear Christian Smalls in various ways. There have been other walkouts at Amazon right over the states, including Michigan and Washington. Now, before we discuss this, I just want to talk about Italy and France, two other countries that I just happen to have picked up where there's also been conflicts with Amazon. There have been many safety failures in Italy and Amazon, and all over Europe there have been strikes at these factories. The one in Milan went out in March after two staff tested positive for COVID-19. The company said they were installing needed health and safety, but the union were unconvinced and said the company were putting profit ahead of workers' safety. Workers at Amazon's Piacenza warehouse, pardon me for the pronunciation, situated just outside of Milan, with 1,100 staff, went on strike saying that the company did not adhere to government rules on the containment of the coronavirus. Union representatives said Amazon was not implementing proper hygiene and social distancing measures. Also in France, in late March, French workers protested in their hundreds, calling on Amazon to cease operations or make it easier for employees not wanting to work during the coronavirus outbreak to stay away. One shipping centre near Orleans, south of Paris, saw 250 to 300 workers go out. There was a quote here from Richard Vives from the CAT Union. Again, I hope I got the pronunciation right. Quote, "We feel really unsafe and I've got colleagues who are coming to work feeling fearful," end quote. CGT representatives for staff at the Franco-Italian chip maker ST Micro, a supplier to iPhone and Tesla, wrote to company bosses asking for its French factories to be temporarily shut. So as ever, the French stand up for themselves very, very well. We could learn a lot from them. Okay, so there's a good few issues rolling around in here. For me, what stands out most here? Well, obviously it's great that these workers have stood up, especially in areas where there's not been traditionally a lot of high-profile fight back. But also the very idea that Amazon, even before this this shutdown, before the lockdowns around the world, could not afford to furlough their staff, is insulting. It's intellectually insulting, and an even bigger insult to the people whose jobs are on the line here. It's hopeful yet disgusting at the same time. Is my view of it. Jamie, what do you take of this?
So, I mean, yeah, I think that's definitely. There's some hope in there, but I think also, you know, I think what we've really seen during COVID is, you know, the reality of the conditions under which many people work today has shocked lots of people. Of, you know, finding out about what happens in an Amazon warehouse, finding out, you know, how most people work today is, you know, COVID has shown a light on these kind of conditions. And I think, you know, Amazon is such a good example. Because, you know, they've made an absolute killing through the COVID pandemic, and none of that is going to workers, none of that's going on PPE and so on. So, you know, it really shows, you know, what these companies would get away with if they could.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's, again, it kind of brings up questions, I think, questions that have not been uncommon within our kind of movements for years about exactly how much is enough, and what exactly you're trying to do here. Where, and I mean, no company like Amazon would publicly admit to attempting to monopolize the market, but it seems pretty obvious to anyone paying attention that that's effectively what they're trying to do. I mean, as I understand, they also I wrote this down as a note. Their server is also used by Netflix, Zoom, and Slack. So the very thing we're talking on now is used by Amazon. I mean, I've boycotted them in my own way for years, but to be honest, I don't think it makes a lot of difference. Jeff Bezos is infamously on his way to being a trillionaire. And I don't think he's noticed that I don't order my stuff from him. But it is pretty appalling in a lot of ways.
As I said, I mean, the only way politically we can hit large corporations like Amazon, who are unscrupulous employers, to be clear, is politically. Last year we're talking, I think, looking at his tax returns, looking at a £9 billion profit. I think it was reported, well, it's not reported, it's factual. He paid something like £300,000 in tax only. And during the first government announcement and the lockdown and the press conference, our political party, for example, just asked big businesses to pay tax. They asked politely, could you pay your taxes? They asked politely. You pay your taxes, but then told people, schools, to get back to work, and in warehouses such in the US and Italy and France, they were just told to put up and shut up, really. I think politically we need to bring these companies to task and stop asking them.
No, I quite agree. And what's interesting for me on this, and I'd like to get, and I've spoken to you about this already, Dave, but I'd like to get Jamie's view on this, is we discussed on the show a couple of weeks ago where I said that I get very agitated by the notion that still is quite hegemonic, if I can use the word that way, throughout society, which is that workers and working class people should be just kind of, well, this is what's available to you. And yes, this and this aren't very good about it, but you should just kind of part with it. And I was saying that my great hope, without minimizing the conditions that other people are having to fight with and live through, but my hope is that when Wetherspoons, for instance, reopens, that people don't go and work for Tim Martin. You know, he's shown himself to be a humanity-hating scumbag who never even wanted to close his pubs in the first place. He doesn't care about his staff. He's sacked them all. As soon as the shutdown came in. And that's kind of part of my issue on this. I really wish that we could get ourselves in a position where if you can't, you know, push these companies into, which I think with different owners you probably can, you can't push these companies into different manners, then we just get rid of their owners. Now, you can, you know, we get rid of the CEO. You and me, Dave, know that very, very well, because although it's not been a vast difference, our company has had some slightly different attitudes towards us in the last few weeks since the previous CEO took a walk. But as companies like that, I just wish they never got the employees in the first place. What do you think, Jack? I mean, how realistic am I being here?
I mean, I think, you know, I think there is a kind of window that's opening around what's happening with COVID of, you know, I think the things that we thought were realistic before the pandemic, or, you know, the things we thought we could do or couldn't do. I think there's a moment where lots of people are saying, you know, things have changed. And I think we need to be optimistic about the things we can do. And optimistic about, you know, who wants to move into struggle and the kind of things that they want to do. So I think, you know, it's a crisis both for, you know, life more generally under the pandemic, but I think it's also a crisis for people who are owning businesses, who are managing businesses, who are pushing people back to work. It's, you know, I think the terrain has changed, and I think the possibilities within that are really different.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's that catching the change and going with it. I have a fear. I mean, I get a bit antsy when anyone talks about, you know, going back to normal when all of this is over. To which I normally reply, I never liked normal very much because it was not beneficial to the majority of working class people. I wonder, can we do that? Can we? I mean, I don't want to, we're getting into realms of predicting here. That's not what we're here for. But that's a question that constantly harangues me, and certainly speaking as a union rep, that is very much prominent in my mind, is can I rally people all over to not just want to get all of this over with as quickly as possible and go back to, because our normal was one of austerity and zero hours and jobs that don't pay, you know, et cetera, no benefits. Yeah. Can we take, what do we need to do to take this optimism forward and turn it into action?
I mean, I think, you know, from my own kind of experience of conversations with people, you know, during the pandemic, you know, I think you're right to say, you know, we can't go back. Well, I mean, we can't go back to normal for a start. You know, things have changed. And the normal was pretty shit for lots of people. You know, there are many people who, you know, when they went into the pandemic, you know, not getting PPE or not being supported is was the norm for the kind of work that they're doing. And I think, you know, there's lots of conversations I've had, and, you know, of course, this is a bit anecdotal, isn't it? But, you know, I think sometimes in those anecdotes, you can start to see the kind of beginnings of other things. There's also people saying, you know, I wanted to get organized before, you know, I wanted to do something at work, and I, you know, I didn't know how to do it, or I was putting it off. And like, now I'm going to do it. Of people kind of crossing a bit of a threshold with that stuff. I think the challenge really is, you know, that optimism I think is out there for some people. But the challenge is like, how do you take those first steps? Like, you know, when you can't sit down and talk about it in person, you can't, you know, have a coffee or go for a beer. And, you know, a lot of our traditions of organizing are like a face-to-face tradition, and that's a bit harder at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to hook people in to, if you like, to do a Zoom call or Skype or whatever. You need to get people interested, I suppose. It's not as easy. Kind of hard getting them interested in a radio show too, isn't it, Dave? But yeah, we do what we can.
Well, I was just on that. So if we go back to Royal Mail, for example, when we met with the TUC, Jamie, and actually the think tank of TUC was actually the best it's been for about 30 years in regards to the COVD stuff, and then working with other unions and getting recognised by the current administration and advertising that they're working with the unions at that time. Anyway, that was the narrative at that time. But what we thought as a union, Jamie, is rather than focus on the individual or the personality, which we traditionally have done, whether it be the right-wing media or the mainstream media who focus on the individual, we actually took a view, let's focus on stopping the strategy, or that particular strategy, which was Royal Mail at that time, the chief executive, wanted to split the company in two and make a separate workforce with inferior terms and conditions, and would have starved the unionised part of the workforce. And we didn't look at Mr. Back, which was the strategy up until the virus. We looked at the strategy. We looked at the strategy, and we took a campaign to convince the British public that he is going to decimate the postal service. And we wrote to the MPs who agreed with us in the main about the 6-day-a-week service looking to be reduced by 5 days. So we took his character out of it and just decimated his strategy. And I think if we take the view, that view with strategies on big business, good terms and conditions, good working conditions, affordable wages, because the other alternative is, if you decimate the trade unions, we're looking at probably the worst recession in our lifetimes.
I mean, I think that's the, you know, that worst recession is starting to bite already, though, isn't it? I mean, I think that's what's kind of hard about figuring out the optimism at the moment is, like, you know, for people who are on furlough, you know, things have been delayed. So people, you know, I guess we're kind of like going through a crisis in slow motion at the moment, which kind of gives people a chance to figure out, like, when else would you have this kind of moment of, you have like a buffer period where you're at home, or you're not at work for lots of people, but you know that there's a likelihood of redundancy periods like coming. Is we're in this kind of like weird in between moment, I think, right now. But I agree with you. You know, I think, you know, in terms of the Royal Mail stuff, like, you know, even if your boss is a good, you know, a nice, friendly person, you know, the strategy that they're putting in is what matters. And I do sometimes think, you know, I worry sometimes about, you know, you look at the Amazon stuff and people focus on just Bezos, for example. It's like, even if he was a nice guy, it would be a horrible company to work for, you know?
Yeah, that's quite correct. There's people, again, there's kind of it's a personalization, I suppose, of neoliberalism, where people are sort of going, but you know, my boss isn't such a bad guy. You know, the amount of times I've had a conversation with people who say things like, oh, well, you know, I know somebody who worked for the Daily Mail, he's an all right bloke. It's like, if he works for the fucking Daily Mail, he isn't. it's not really a discussion there. But yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, I quite agree. Just moving on quickly for the... So, sorry, just to kind of tidy up this bit, a bit about Amazon. Total support for any of the organisations going on there. What can people do individually? I made a couple of notes here from stuff I've noticed. Boycotting Amazon is, I suspect, not as effective as I would like it to be. Christian Smalls has actually said we should boycott, and a worker-led boycott for some people is the only type that's legitimate. But for those of you who basically are not going to stop buying toys, or for those of you that are getting your needed food supplies even, you could leave out a bit of hand sanitizer maybe, or some masks if you've got any spare, which you could put a sign saying, asking your delivery person to take it. We can also support the striking workers. I know it's not as easy when they're on the other, from where we're talking now, they're on the other side of the world, and they are, you know, we're not doing street gatherings anyway, but it's good if we can. In Chicago, there are members of the DSA and other community members organized and participated in a car picket, which is quite interesting, supporting, honking their support for Amazon workers in regards to coronavirus protection. And you can always put up signs in your window. I know it's only a little thing, but you know, it means a lot to people there. Let me see, there's always the selfies and the social media and holding up signs saying you support them. That's something you young people do. It's not something I do. There is a Facebook page called Prime Member Solidarity with Amazonians United. It's a bit of a mouthful, which is also worth checking out. But there's also a petition. Tell Amazon close exposed facilities and give all workers 100% paid leave now. And that is on the actionnetwork.org, if you can find that. And I'll send that to Dave. We can put it in the show description. This petition calls on Amazon to give all workers 100% paid leave now, plus hazard pay and an end to retaliation against protesting workers. Also, on the same site, there is a petition calling for state governors to close Amazon warehouses that fail to protect workers and public health. This is all in America, this particular one, citing the excellent example of Kentucky's Democratic Governor Andy Beshear, who closed down a non-essential Amazon warehouse while guaranteeing workers full pay. And I'd be interested to know more about that, because if it's a governor who's closing that down and guaranteeing full pay, does that mean he's taken it on as a local government thing? In which case, it's still good it's closed, obviously, but I don't see how Amazon should get away without actually paying their own workers.
Well, I think the...
I'll look into...
The Senate system, or the House system in America, yeah, is really odd. And this, the statistics in the US, which I always thought was quite sort of right-wing, apart from the metropolitan areas, but looking at the statistics on all social proposals... It gets over 60% votes, things like free healthcare, free education, free universities, equal rights, same-sex marriages. They all get 60% approvals, but they regularly vote in governments that go against those statistics. And these are all from different polling companies. So a lot of the socialist ideas, it is over 60%, yes. But for some odd reason, because of the rigged political system out there, or the electoral votes system, they never really get in. But they're all democratic. The actual fact, they're democratic policies, if that means anything these days. And they're fairly unanimous amongst all the polling companies. But they never get a government or vote in a government to carry out those policies. So I think if we use this opportunity to look at our voting system.
There is the voting system. I'm a little cynical about that too, but the voting system's important. Well, Jamie, you need to give your view on this before I
Just one of those polling was a unanimous. It was like over 70% in the UK as well for electronic voting, which people feel would get a good turnout. So again, maybe use this opportunity. Because I see this, what's happened recently, as a level.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but also we've been fighting that even just in our bloody union, mate. We haven't, we're still not doing it, are we? That's an argument all over the world. Sorry, Jamie, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been interesting seeing how some of the polling has shifted more recently in the US as well. You know, with huge numbers of people supporting the Black Lives Matter protests, you know, the kind of youth vote around Bernie and so on. I think, you know, there is a challenge in the US though of, you know, translating popular votes into actual change, which, you know, I think the electoral system is one of those barriers, but I think, you know, there are a whole number of ways of like diffusing popular sentiment and drive for things in the US, which, you know, they've had a lot of practice at, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there is that. I also struggle a little bit with... I'm a little cynical about this because I do think, yes, there is the system and the way it's set up. But I also fear that, okay, and I think we've had this in this country too, where sometimes what people say and what they vote is different. I think sometimes people kind of tell you what they perhaps imagine you want to hear and then go and do something else.
This polling data that I've just read was from 2 years ago. As Jamie said, it's probably even stronger now. But yeah, because of the system, people tend to believe what they read. And as I said, the whole system into getting that information out there is rigged. But on the other hand, a lot of the normal, not left-wing, because I said I'm going to be saying what's right morally and what's wrong morally. So what's right morally, a lot of these alternative views, like Navarro Media and a lot of the Twitter and social media companies have been doing since this lockdown, is getting that information out there via Facebook. And hopefully people reading an alternative view. Because when we say let's go back to normal. Well, normal wasn't right. We all know that now.
Yeah.
It just wasn't right. You can't say the normal because normal wasn't right. So that's what we get back to, isn't it? And use this opportunity to say, well, yeah, look, I never thought I'd saw a Conservative government say on a press conference we're working with the unions. I'd never seen it before, you know. It just was like kicked out of the 80s like it didn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what I'm trying to say, I'm a tad more cynical on this because I know what you say, Dave, but the 80s was such a terrible decade. It was so terrible, it gave us the 90s and the early 2000s, which were just the worst fucking times.
No, exactly, and that's what I'm saying. And I say she because I don't know her and I won't call her. I know people say Maggie and Bojo. I don't know these people personally, so I shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying she marginalised TUC and trade unions. You never mentioned them at all. Certainly not in press conferences. And certainly not with a cabinet of paedophiles, which we found out later. But them to come out in the 21st century and felt that they should, even if they appear to care, to say trade unions. And sometimes, and it's quite right, the Amazon Ferris Warehouse is taking industrial action, certainly in some countries which were traditionally did. But we had to think alternatively as trade unions about industrial actions. Industrial action during this time, because a lot of industrial action you're relying on the public support, and I just don't think we would have got it in this country with industrial action. I'm not saying it's easy, I'm just saying we have to rethink the strategy and not the characters. Rethink the strategy, because sometimes you need, if you get an exit, if you name something and do something as a trade union or as a movement, you have to have an exit strategy. Because the first thing as a trade union is to get the employer to the table and talk about it and marginalise them and push them back. And not necessarily the character. You need to push back the strategy. It's the strategy we should be concentrating on, their strategy or the company's strategy. And Amazon, as I said, they need to come out now and do a real campaign on them as an employer, their behaviour as an employer. So
yeah, we can all amplify that, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, I mean because we can rock them all we want and we can have industrial action. Yeah, we'll have industrial action. But we couldn't do it at this particular time, which normally results in public, or has to result in public support. Would you send your kids to work for that company? Would you appeal to that older crowd? So we had to rethink our strategy and sit down with the Conservatives. And we were meeting with the Conservatives regularly and with the TUC Think Box. And they were meeting with us. And we were controlling the narrative in press conferences, up to a point anyway.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think the strategy question is a really, really important one, like both for like figuring out the strategy of the employer, but also, you know, I think, you know, I've been to a number of industrial, you know, kind of periods of industrial action in the university over the last couple of years where there has just been no strategy for the strikes. And I think, you know, figuring out like what kind of action is going to win, you know, what kind of action are people going to take, or, you know, in the context of what you guys have been talking about, like what will the public support, like how do you build that campaign, is I think sometimes there's a risk of thinking like strikes are strikes, there's like one way to do them, or there's like one kind of way of using strikes to gain concessions. And I think that's what's kind of exciting for me about seeing the stuff in the US at the moment, of like experiments with different strategies. You know, with the return of wildcat action in various places, of like people figuring out, like, you know, there's an immediacy to the stuff around the pandemic. Like you want PPE, or like you want safety straight away. So I think it's making people much more strategic about like where is their power at work. And obviously, you know, people haven't figured this out. It's like the beginning of an experiment, but it feels very exciting. In a kind of shift from, you know, symbolic one day strikes or whatever that we've had before.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's a very good point. Yeah, it's sometimes the situation around you gives you a better clarity around your strategy. I've seen in recent times lots of trending on Twitter and whatnot about something called PlayStation 5. As the games consultant here, Jamie, tell this old geezer, is there something about this I should care about? Is it exciting or what? What's happening?
That's a good question, eh? I think there's some interesting stuff with this, of like, you know, not to go too much down the rabbit hole, I guess, but, you know, a new console is the kind of beginning of a fight between two different camps of capital over who is going to make money out of video games. Mm. And in a kind of weird way, the announcement about the new ones is like both a good and a bad thing in a sense, because there used to be like regular periods of time where a company would sell consoles and then force people to upgrade to the next one. And the spaces between those things have got longer and longer, because, you know, capital is trying to get more out of its investment in each generation of consoles. Mm. And now they're trying to sell the latest, most expensive version. Literally, it will come out, you know, in the midst of the biggest economic crisis we've ever had. So for the games industry, this is, you know, is it exciting? I guess it would be if they, you know, were confident that they could sell these things. But, you know, I think there's been this kind of idea that video games, you know, in the UK at least, are like a place where economic growth is going to be built around making video games and so on. And I think, you know, what happens with these consoles is going to be kind of important. Plus they might be fun. I mean, you know, maybe I should do a bit more field work on that.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, there's some very interesting points coming up with this. I mean, the first thing I think of is purely appearance based. Because when you talk about the middle of the pandemic being the way it is, I always think of when there's a new console out, I think of those midnight queues outside games shops and stores where people want to be, you know, one of the first people to get hold of the new console or the new game. That, of course, isn't going to happen. So how is that going to materialize? Is, again, are we going to see this, and this is also very relevant for the kind of workers that we were just talking about, at Amazon or whatever, are you going to be delivering from, are they going to be like a midnight delivery? Do you know what I mean? Like someone might sign up for it, yeah, and just go, yeah, I want this. So if you're in the Harrow area, like one of us is at the moment, or both of us are at the moment, you know, is there going to be like a depot not far from here that goes, right, everyone, we've got a midnight crew coming in. Which, by the way, if I'm correct in assuming, Dave, is you still get the late allowance for the work in that time, do you?
Well, we do as a unionised workforce. We do attract an allowance.
Okay.
And it's pensionable. But you're right, John. As trade unionists for a service, I never say company. Me and John never say company. Like, we get told a lot of things like company, but me and John choose to ignore it because it's right. Yes. A service, we will look at that as... a job grower, but it worries me because we're trying to push manual labour, because it is a form of manual labour. I'm not embarrassed to say that, but we're pushing a piece of equipment for people not to go out to work. Not horrible, I don't mean that horribly, I mean people to, you know, because I'll talk about will we be rushing in the digital revolution? That's what I'm saying. I know me and John want that work for a service because it provides pensions and good terms and conditions and good wage rises, but who will we be delivering it to, John? You know, if we don't get our unions in the right place in regards to building things in the UK, because John, I always use this analogy, and that's fantastic what John says about the biggest social institution we've got in this country is the NHS. I always say that. Yes, I love that phrase, John. And we can build on that, and building things in this country, building things, making things work, not relying so much on a global finance industry from 1986, which fallen on its arse, isn't it? It's fallen on its arse. The whole system's fallen on its arse. So we could build something and start pushing a strategy or a campaign to say, well, we wouldn't... any sort of company that relies... or any sort of service that relies on guilds or PFIs, private finance initiatives from global markets, we could actually say, well, if we didn't globally market it and nationalise it, we wouldn't, if everything falls on its arms, it would still be there.
I would say this, actually, and it's not just because Jamie's on the show this week, but I do think his book, Marks at the Arcade, is very, very good detail about the different levels of work that go into the different strata in the games industry, because it is an industry. And again, I'll be interested to see how the games unions, Games Workers Unite, etc., respond to what comes up with PlayStation 5. I would say this to anyone, particularly working the kind of delivery sectors we've been talking about. Just remember, no one gets their stuff unless you bring it to them. Okay, so that's, I'm not telling you what to do or how to do it. I'm just telling you the level of power that you have. Okay, no one gets anything unless you bring it to them.
And the day before the PlayStation 5 launch is like a pretty good day to not bring something, hey?
Yeah.
There's power there.
There's a tremendous amount of power there.
Yeah.
For instance, just you know, your workplace doesn't have enough PPE. As Jamie said, the day before the console and its new games come out. Might be a good time to ask for PPE or say, you know, nice console you got there. It's a shame no one's going to deliver it.
Yeah, I mean, health and safety is non-negotiable, John, isn't it?
It's
in legislation. You can't negotiate. It's safe or it isn't safe.
Quite correct. And we've said this on the show a few times. I'd like to say it again. Section 44 of the Employment Rights Act 1996. If your workplace is unsafe for yourself, your colleagues or any customers, you are well within your rights to refuse to work there.
Just a quick one. Oh, if people individually are worried about themselves, if you go to the TUC website, if you join a union, then collectively we'll tell you it's not safe. Join a union.
Spotify. there's a dispute going on at Spotify. Another little story has not really been taken up by most media outlets. But fortunately, our friends at United Voices of the World are yet again fighting the good fight on this one. Actually, this is something that they flagged up back in April, but I haven't had enough time to mention it on the show until now. And I wanted to wait until this one, this week's one anyway. Cleaners working at Spotify's HQ in London have taken action over their treatment, particularly relating to health and safety. They've been told to keep cleaning the building, which also houses The Economist magazine, despite the building being empty. And this means they're still getting to work, which, as we know, for so many people requires public transport, and there's a lot of danger involved in doing that. The employees have also said that there's no proper PPE provision, and they feel they've had their health knowingly put in danger by the employer. Some of the most shocking allegations are that managers misled staff over confirmed cases of COVID-19 and had them unknowingly disinfecting infected areas. JPC Cleaning Services Limited has refused to furlough employees. United Voices of the World has vowed to escalate this dispute, and it's worth noting that the building is a Delphi building owned by Amanico Ortega, one of the richest men in the world. So far, UVW have forced JPC to backdate cleaners' pay and gain the London Living Wage, but obviously this is not enough in the climate of this terrible pandemic and for people being forced to clean empty offices. So, yeah, probably not the only story like this, but always worth highlighting these things. It's interesting that cleaning has become probably the most important job in the world right now. Because when you're a cleaner, you're a germ killer. You're a germ assassin, basically. And that is the most important thing you can do right now. It really is, when it comes down to it, the only way this virus or any others like it will be come any close to being defeated in any way. Nevertheless, you're still paid like shit. You're still given the worst hours. You're still not given proper provisions. And you're even lied to by an employer that's not giving you PPE about where your area of the offices actually has some COVID infections, allegedly. What do we make of this, lads? Who wants to go first?
Yeah, I mean, I think the story at Spotify is a really, really common story. I find it, hearing all this stuff about people now talking about key workers and essential workers is, these workers were essential before the crisis. And, in London, it's predominantly migrant workers who these companies, these outsourcing companies, deliberately employ low paid, they push people onto low paid contracts, and they employ migrant workers because they think that they can get away with not giving them employment rights. And I think what UVW have done, with those workers, supporting them to fight back against these multinational companies is really, really inspiring. It's a really good story of people standing up for their rights. And I think, it should be told everywhere.
This, I'm learning a lot today, me and John especially, because when John's talked about PlayStation and we imagine there's queues at night and that, it's funny, John, isn't it? But we never looked at, I'm not criticising our age, we just never looked at that, Jamie, and when John just mentioned the Spotify dispute, and it's amazing, really, because that thing about key workers, I think that's extended now, isn't it? And I do agree with you on the fantastic work by UVW, because it's not something that any metropolitan area would shout about before this awful COVID thing, that we underpay people. It's really great. And then all of a sudden they're heroes and that. But the other side of it is, I think the digital workers could be regarded or would be regarded as key workers as well. As time, I see it happening. There was a time when I was at 20 years, but it's much, much shorter than that. Is Spotify owned by Apple, Jamie, or is it owned by one particular massive?
No, as far as I know, it's not, but it runs on Amazon Web Services. So this kind of hidden Amazon monopoly kind of behind the scenes, which, Netflix, Spotify, Zoom, all these companies run, but the physical hardware is owned by Amazon. So these are, you know, but I think that's what's good about this story. Hey? Like, these companies think of themselves as digital, you know, entirely new companies, but they're still doing the same stuff other companies do, you know, low paid workers cleaning up after them. You know, there's still old stuff in with the new, you know.
Yeah, I saw, we saw there was something on the BBC about it, and I was actually amazed. Now you mention it, and it spoke about Amazon's secret technology monopoly on all these running all these platforms based on people's terrible working conditions and their minimum wage. And just like really branching out into this digital stuff and literally taking hold of people, what their trends are, where they live, what time they wake up, what they eat, what they watch. It's quite scary, actually, now you think about it.
No, I quite agree. But also, coming back to your point, Jamie, is this whole idea of the kind of launching digital platforms as some kind of totally new realm of work, where it's absolute bollocks. I mean, as we've seen here, it's these places still operate in offices that require maintenance and cleaning. They still have a physical product that requires manufacture and delivery, etc. So yeah, it's just a delusional crap, really. It's very, very typical, I think, of late period capitalism to just constantly try and dress something up as the new in a society that's become totally incapable of actually creating anything new, as we've discussed on the show before. And as I think there's some very good points made by Mark Fisher, among others, in Capitalist Realism about the inability to create anything new. Actually, in reference to this, before we move on, there's one video that I've, in relation to both video games and Mark Fisher, which is by a YouTuber called Cuck Philosophy, which is, some of you might have heard of this, but he did one about capitalist realism, which I recommend. It's about 11 minutes, but it's very, very interesting.
So I think, you know, in a similar kind of vein to the Spotify campaign, there's IWGB, which is Sister Union of UVW, has been organizing a campaign of couriers that work for a company called TDL, it's the Doctor's Laboratory. And basically what they do is, it's an international, you know, it's an Australian private medical company that has this subsidiary here in London. So it's a privatized part of the NHS that does COVID sample testing. And the IWGB has organized these drivers for, like, you know, a couple of years now. They've won better conditions. They you know, have proper contracts and so on. And they've used COVID to victimize the bicycle couriers and drive them out of the company. So they said that they had to make them redundant, which, you know, imagine a laboratory that tests COVID samples, you know, can't imagine they would have much work on it. It's worth having a look at because, you know, this is a dispute that, like, you know, it brings together kind of, you know, gig economy, career, kind of working conditions. People have fought back against it. You know, there's the story of the NHS being privatized through the back door here. And, you know, ordinary people standing up to fight back against these kind of multinational companies that are, you know, they're ripping off the taxpayer, they're ripping off consumers. So, you know, I think it's a, you know, the fight of those couriers is another one of these things to be really, really optimistic about during the pandemic, you know, of people standing up to these companies.
One other thing I just want to throw a bit of light on this week was a story last month that the BBC covered, which was to reveal more 18 to 24 year old workers are presently earning less than before the coronavirus outbreak, based on research by the Resolution Foundation. It found that risks their pay being affected for years, in fact, is what's going on at the moment, while older workers may experience involuntary retirement early. Drop in employment and increase in claims on unemployment rose at the end of March, and particularly in areas like hospitality and construction. So yeah, I just wanted to throw a little bit of light on that issue. By all means, we can talk about this. I'm not quite sure what to say, really, because I don't know where else we can say, you know, what we can do to kind of prevent this outside of what Dave said earlier, which was join a union.
Well, it appears that things are trying to creep back in as the economy, or the people that make the economy happen, and it seems to be creeping back in. And it's amazing what things like the Black Lives Matter campaign can do, in that it seems like the whole world has, because of the digital stuff where we see things live on the fly as they happen. And it's amazing what can happen. I'm not talking industrial action. I'm talking about legitimate anger or protests. And people seem to have just about had enough. And it's how we get these things that are creeping back in. And again, focus on the strategy to push it back. Whether that be a strategy of not necessarily industrial action, but writing to your MPs and building campaigns, big solid campaigns, and using this great alternative media that's coming out, in which a lot of the youngsters seem to be looking at, you know, and they will always turn around and say, yeah, I saw something about that on Twitter, I saw something about that on Facebook. They'll never say I saw something about it in the newspaper because they don't buy it.
I heard something about that on All the Rage.
Yeah, so it's just how we rethink as unions and trade unions, rethinking our strategy and talking to people, because we have been during this terrible time, we have been talking to people. We have.
Completely agree. I mean, I think there's a big challenge for the trade union movement around this stuff is, you know, lots of young workers haven't been in unions before. You know, lots of young workers haven't been taught about employment rights. But the question of connecting them with unions is that, you know, unions also need to listen to these young workers. Mm. You know, like, what are their concerns? What do they want to do? How do they want to do it? And that's a big challenge for all of us in the union movement of, like, how do we take our traditions and our experiences and make them relevant and make sense for people who are fighting exploitation at work, you know, whether they know it or not, you know, trying to get by in contemporary life. You know, there is a kind of fight over what kind of work they're going to end up doing. And, you know, for lots of people, they're losing that fight. And, you know, I think it's a kind of big question for us about how we can support people and figure out how they can change their work for themselves.
Looking at the statistics, union membership has grown 970,000 new joiners across the whole board, which is hasn't risen above that for years, I'd say a decade. So that's been a positive thing. It's just how we use it rather than the traditional strategies, coming up with a new strategy on, as I said, politically as well. If the TUC have got the government's ear, whoever the government is, and we should be using that. It's interesting to know that the government announced that kids could go back to school. The teachers' union stood up and said, well, not for our members, it isn't. And they've now backed down on a lot of that stuff.
And that's exactly, I think, something that's very important to leave people, leave listeners with this week, which is those examples of where working class and trade union activity has actually won some great benefits for people, some strength for people, and some action. Thanks again.
Yeah, lovely to come on and talk, as always.
I just want to say in closing to listeners, you can find Jamie Woodcock's great book, Marx at the Arcade.
So it's Haymarket Books.
That's Haymarket, yeah. And your previous book about working the phones is also there. That's on Pluto. Okay, so you can get all that too. Yeah, get that. He also edits or co-edits Notes from Below. It's a really, really good resourceful website. I recommend you check it out. He is also going to be playing the PlayStation 5 and trying to convince me that games are interesting at some point in the future, which I look forward to another show when you do that, actually. That would be quite good.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.